This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. 3 years after moving to New York City, Maggie Wrigley found herself on the edge of homelessness. It was 1987. She and her boyfriend at the time had been living in a warehouse in Brooklyn, but their landlord was shady and they didn't trust him.
We weren't going to stay and pay him all this money, and you know, he got kind of crazy and violent. We didn't really know where we were going to go.
Around that time, they heard about an abandoned tenement building on the Lower East Side. It was owned by the city, but it had been left empty and unmaintained. A friend told them a group of squatters had taken it over and started to fix it up. It was a place they could live without paying rent to a landlord.
And he said, there's an open space. If you want to come, it's rough. We were like, we need a place to go.
So Wrigley and her boyfriend packed up their belongings and drove their old car from Brooklyn into Manhattan.
And Maggie and her boyfriend discovered that when their friend said the building was rough, he wasn't kidding.
That's producer Delaney Hall. The building was full of rubble. Some of the walls were rotten and falling down.
You got to open a hydrant with a wrench and then fill up these water buckets and carry them back into the house. And it wasn't fun.
It wasn't just the building that was falling down. The whole Lower East Side, which today is filled with expensive boutiques and high-end condos, was struggling in the 1980s.
There were empty lots filled with trash and falling down buildings everywhere. In fact, Wrigley's building wasn't the only property in the neighborhood that had been taken over by squatters. By the late 1980s, squatters would come to occupy more than a dozen old tenements on the Lower East Side. In the 1960s and 70s, New York City began hollowing out. The city lost many of its manufacturing jobs, and people with means started moving to the suburbs. Property values started to slide.
When landlords couldn't make a profit anymore by renting out their buildings in low-income neighborhoods to low-income tenants, they would start what's called milking them.
This is Dr. Amy Starcheski. She's an anthropologist and an oral historian.
So they were trying to continue to collect rents but increase their profits by not spending any money on the building. First, they would stop providing services, heat, hot water, stop making repairs. They would also stop paying taxes.
When that happened, the city could take possession of the building. The city ended up owning tens of thousands of properties
that were in poor condition, full of poor people, and which hadn't been taken care of properly for a long time.
All of which meant terrible housing conditions for the people that remained, and lots of opportunities for squatters.
The squatters set about fixing up their decrepit buildings, clearing rubble, building stairs, reinforcing walls, and replacing windows. They illegally tapped into the city's electric grid and water system.
Everybody worked together.
Maggie Wrigley again.
I mean, I built this house. You know, I raised my floors. You know, I wired electricals.
Many squatters may have lived outside the mainstream, but in some ways they were tapping into mainstream American values that go way back in history.
Values of self-sufficiency, entrepreneurialism, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, individual responsibility. Squatting fits in with that story too.
But the city government didn't necessarily see it that way. And as time went on, the squatters' renegade methods would draw more critical attention in a city that was rapidly gentrifying.
By the late 1980s, New York City had turned a corner and was gradually starting to come out of a long economic slump. People were moving back into the city, real estate prices were once again starting to climb, and the city was beginning to reinvest in neighborhoods it had long neglected. The issues of homelessness and housing on the Lower East Side were becoming more and more tense. Both squatters and homeless people felt like they had to fight to hang on to whatever spaces they had claimed.
Do not try to kick the homeless out of the parks, because if you do, you got a war on your hands, sir.
The Tompkins Square Park riots were a turning point in the relationship between squatters and the city that brought a lot of the tensions around gentrification and displacement and class in the neighborhood to a head.
As criticism mounted, the city began working harder to evict the squatters. And in response, the squatters began devising creative ways to resist eviction. Here's Wrigley again.
We had barricades in the house, and that was the mentality that we were living with. You know, we always had signs. You can't let anyone in the house. No HPD, no fire, no Con Ed, no nothing.
And when the police did show up, the squatters had developed a plan for how to quickly mobilize. the eviction watch.
Squatters would physically block police from entering the building. They'd link arms and stand in front of the door.
They would have little secret compartments and hiding places to go, and, you know, physically occupying the building was always the best strategy.
The squatters weren't just fighting the city in the streets. They also began devising a legal strategy based on a theory called adverse possession. The details of the law vary state by state. In New York, it says that if you occupy a piece of property for 10 years and the legal owner doesn't force you out, you can claim the legal title.
To successfully claim adverse possession, the squatters would need to meet a number of conditions, like proving they had lived in the buildings continuously, for example. Some of the squatters were wary about getting tangled up with the legal system, but others saw it as their chance to gain ownership.
The squatters hired a lawyer, started putting together a case, and entered into a legal battle with the city that went on for years. The fighting finally came to an end in 1999, when the city and the squatters began to discuss what at one point had seemed impossible: legalization. In 2002, the city effectively turned over 11 buildings to the squatters for $1 each. And the squatters began turning their buildings from squats into legal, cooperatively owned apartments. There have been hard trade-offs. But for many, like Maggie Wrigley, the legalization has been a victory for affordable housing in one of the most expensive cities in the country. And it's offered a kind of stability at the end of nearly two decades of drama. There's not that sense of constant threat, the fear that police might come by and brick up all their windows. Maggie's not a squatter anymore. She's something else.
I am a homeowner, and it's incredible. And, you know, as long as we keep our act together, then nobody can put us out, you know. And that's it. We got it, you know. It's our building. It's ours to lose.
99% Invisible is Delaney Hall, Kurt Kohlstedt, Katie Mingle, Sharif Youssef, Avery Truffleman, Emmett Fitzgerald, Taryn Mazza, Sean Rial, and me, Roman Mars. Edited for radio by Vika Aronson. We are a project of 91.7 KALW and Radiotopia. Find out more at 99pi.org.